Right Heart, the Catholic podcast that believes that a heart guided by solid spiritual formation is a heart we can follow. You are listening to episode 6. After you listen to the episode, head over to therightheartpodcast.com for all the show notes, which will have pictures, links to what we talked about, and a summary of our main thoughts from the episode. Don't forget also to check out my blog, Humble Handmade, at humblehandmade.com. I could not be more excited about my guest today. Her name is Sarah Denny, and we have tried actually several times to have her get over here in the studio, and technical difficulties and freak rainstorms have prevented that, but I do have her on the phone, and we are just going to make it work today because she has some amazing things to share with us. So Sarah, welcome.
Thanks, Erin. I'm really happy to be with you.
So you guys, I have to do that thing where I have this really long, glowing introduction because Sarah is so worth it. She is really, she's one of those people that I would say she gets more and more beautiful the more you get to know her. She is passionate about reaching the hearts of women. I would say that is one thing that's very clear to me since I first met her. She's a New Orleans native. She has a master's in theology from Notre Dame Seminary and a certification in healthcare ethics from the National Catholic Bioethics Center. She also is a Creighton Model fertility care practitioner and is currently pursuing her doctorate in bioethics. Sarah is so passionate about what it means to be a woman and how women who are aware of their authentic femininity can positively influence our culture in so many good ways. Sarah, I apologize for the glowing introduction, but you deserve it. You're such a gift, and I'm thankful to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, guys, today we are going to be talking about women, our gifts, our nature, our feminine genius, as St. Pope John Paul II called it, and why there's really no one-size-fits-all way to express our femininity. So, Sarah, to start us off, I love your story that you have about kind of your tipping point with regards to how you got interested in femininity at all and feminism at all, and feeling that there is something missing in, I guess, popular culture's view of what it means to be a woman.
Yes. So I don't know that when I signed up for this particular class that I took in college that I was aware of how it would affect the rest of my life. I'm sure I had no idea in the moment, but I actually took this Introduction to Women's Studies class. It was about 7 years ago. I was just finishing up my freshman year of college. And in this class, you know, I think I had the sense that it was going to be a little bit different when on the first day we had to go around the classroom, we had to say our name, and then we had to say our biological sex, and we had to say our gender. And so I kind of just planted that in the back. I thought it was, you know, self-evident. What that meant, but yeah. I realized, you know, okay, this is where the culture is, and this is something that people, you know, they're speaking about, they're arguing about, they're debating about, et cetera. So the class really became a place where we discussed many interesting things, but one particular topic just came up, you know, even just the sense of male chivalry and what is that and does it still exist. And we had a specific homework assignment that at some point in time between the next class, when we're on campus, if any man tried to open the door for one of us, we were supposed to say, no, I can do that myself, wait for him to walk through the door, and then, of course, open the door ourselves and walk through. In the moment, it was one of those things that looking back now, I just laugh when I think of it because it's so absurd, in my opinion, that I couldn't help but laugh, you know. But in the moment, in the classroom, it wasn't as laughable to most of the people I was with. And so I just raised my hand and asked the teacher, you know, I said, I don't really understand. I said, what if he is just trying to be a gentleman and open the door for me? Like, why would that be harmful for me to let him do that? And she very quickly and clearly told me that, you know, gentlemen do not exist in this society and that that's not the option. You know, this is what the assignment is. So, you know, I think it's more of a thought experiment. I didn't really participate in that assignment because I thought it was so absurd. But from that moment, I think that was probably a turning point, not just within, you know, my life, but in that class, because it made me stop and start to question, okay, this isn't just this class that I'm in. Like, this is something that's happening outside of this classroom, within society, within our particular culture. and what is actually going on. And I started asking myself questions about what is feminism? Like, why are we studying, quote, woman? What does that mean? What does it mean to be a woman? And I started to see in this particular class and through the discussions that we would have that, first of all, you know, there's a lot of anger and there's a lot of hurt. And so even the teacher speaking and telling me that gentlemen don't exist, you know, I can say that I've been blessed to know gentlemen and men who, you know, would be living chivalrous lives. But the reality is that not all men would subscribe to that kind of way of life. And it would be false for me to claim that all the women I was with were also able to have those kinds of experiences that I was blessed, even though I don't think I realized it at the time, but that I was blessed to grow up with. So I really started to see, okay, so the reality is that men for a long time have felt this sort of almost domination and power that men have tried to exert over them. And, you know, realizing and being very honest with the fact that this is even something that we can look back in Genesis, not that this particular part was talked about in this class, trust me, but through my reflections since. You know, we look back, though, in Genesis 3, and even in after the fall, when God is talking about, you know, the effects of the fall and what that means, like he says to the woman, that your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And, of course, you know, what God the Father meant is his intention in creating man and woman was that they would both equally, but in different ways, just live out an expression of what it means to be human, like live out a unique expression of human nature. And he did not create them to be at odds with one another, but with the entrance of sin, you know, the entrance of division, the fall, it became that woman's desire, which is very good for her husband, could sometimes, unfortunately, you know, the man, by his own choices, could use his power that is meant to serve and offer, like, reverence on behalf of woman, like we see in Ephesians 5, which is the ordered context. We can look back at the fall and see this is where it all started.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fall, it makes sense and it is true and good to acknowledge that women have suffered in different ways at the hands of men. You know, so I've gained a lot of just grace from the Lord and wisdom that he's given me through the years. In that moment, I just thought these people were crazy. I was like, what are they talking about? You know, but I really was struck, I will say, more than anything at the time by just the authentic hurt and anger that they had. And I knew that I don't know these people personally, but in their stories that they had legitimate and real experiences, that if we were ever have a conversation, I needed to first acknowledge that and also show them that those experiences matter, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And really, so what you're saying is the whole idea or the movement of feminism, I guess, especially over the last, you know, 115 years or so, really began with a good intention and a need that needed to be addressed. And
yes.
Maybe actually you could kind of explain from your worldview, you know, your education that you have a lot more than me, at least, what that view looks like from a balanced perspective from kind of the beginning with, I think it was Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was kind of the beginning of it.
Exactly. So Elizabeth Cady Stanton and a group of women, they wrote something called the Declaration of Sentiment. And, you know, it was kind of based on the Declaration of Independence, which, you know, we might kind of laugh at, but I think it was quite ingenious at the time. And they were just trying to express through writing all these different ways that they felt that at the hands of men, they were not being treated equally. And if we look back to the 1800s, which, you know, honestly, it's not that long ago. So I do think it's something that we should encourage all our young women, especially to look back at recent history and to learn from that and even far history. But so right there, we see this list of all the ways that woman has felt that she has not been treated equally. So she's voicing them and asking that even the legal system, right, that there would be an acknowledgement of those differences so that they could then change and work towards equality. It is ironic that they actually, the one that they kind of had to hold up that people were disagreeing on the most was woman's right to vote. And so at a certain time, I believe they had to take that out so that they could pass all these other things. Because as we know, you know, this was the late 1800s. We did not actually receive the right to vote until around 1920, which was the 19th Amendment. So, you know, looking back, we can see, I think people often just kind of put all these women into this one box and they say, oh my gosh, you're a feminist. This means you're crazy and you're angry and you want to treat men like XYZ. But the reality is that the feminist movement truly started out as a good movement. And even, you know, John Paul II in his different writings recognizes that woman has fought for time for her equality, and that's not a bad thing necessarily. The question is, how are we fighting for that, and in what way are we treating ourselves and honoring ourselves and respecting ourselves, or are we not in those actions that we take to fight for equality? So as things kind of like moved forward, we entered into what we would call third-wave feminism, which is something that I would say you would be more recognized as today's sort of form of feminism. So through the last century, you know, where it did start with these good intentions, and I still think there are good intentions and we can always find them and we should look for those good intentions because that's kind of our bridge to be able to have conversation, you know, that we're acknowledging that women still today, that there are ways in which we are not treated equally in different systems of society and the culture and legally, et cetera. You know, even just the pay, the amount of salary that a woman gets in the same job that a man has, you know, so stopping and kind of looking at those things. And I think some of the words I've been using just to kind of, I would say, hone in on like the most important part, I would say to really test whether or not a form of feminism is what I would call an authentic feminism, that which is, you know, in light of John Paul II's writings and how the church views women and the form of feminism that is truly uplifting for a woman's dignity. So we're asking, like, is it like that, or is it this almost third wave feminism, which is more so, I would say, unfortunately, most of the time that I've seen it acted out, would be a form of feminism which, in seeking to almost flip it on its head, so man has dominated woman for so long, we now want to gain our equality, but sometimes it even becomes that woman now wants to dominate man, almost in revenge for all of this past history in which they've been subdued under their power. So I would say that that's kind of the most important question because, you know, because people ask me, I was speaking at a high school recently, and they were juniors in high school, young men, and we were talking about different things. And at one point, their teacher just thought it was funny to introduce me like this. But I was like, oh, my gosh, like he just opened up this huge can of worms. Because he's like, here's Miss Betty, and she's a feminist. And I'm like, oh, gosh, okay, let me explain what that means for a second, you know. And so I acknowledged to them, I was like, you know what, actually, he's right, though. I am a feminist. But let me tell you what I mean by that. And I explain that, as I would say, I'm a feminist. I'm a feminist in light of John Paul II, what he's written, what the church has offered us. And the reality is that as a woman, we have each been created uniquely to express in a feminine capacity the gift of what it means to be human. And though it's not the same as our counterparts, our brothers in Christ, you know, the men that are in the world, though it's not the same, it's no less important. So, you know, this huge understanding that, like, equality does not mean sameness. In John Paul II, I think one of the biggest things that's kind of, I'd almost say hidden, I don't feel like people talk about this part as much, but is that he was always, you know, while he's calling out to a woman to be who she is, he doesn't give her these, like, rules that are hard and fast, like, do this, do this, do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. But there is one that he does say, which I think is important since he does it so few times, is that he does say, like, women, in trying to work for your equality, to help others recognize your dignity, he's, like, begging them, like, please do not masculinize yourself. And here's the deal. He doesn't do this in some black and white way. I feel like people use that term maybe almost, just kind of almost, like, too much when they're trying to explain how a woman's acting without maybe knowing the whole situation. Like, I would be very careful before I walk up to someone and I'm like, you're acting very masculine. You know? Like, yeah. I would not go that route. But the reality that in certain ways, I think we do have to stop and ask ourselves, like, the actions that I'm taking, am I doing this because it's me being who I am as a woman, or am I doing this because I'm trying to one-up a man, you know?
Yeah. You know, Sarah, one thing that came to mind for that's very, like, practical, like, on the ground level with feminism in our culture is the very widespread idea that it's funny to put down your husband or your boyfriend, like, roll your eyes at them, just be like, oh my gosh, that big loud, he can't do anything, and like, or that men will just never understand us because we're so superior to them. And that is in every party is going to have conversation where men are the butt of a joke, right? So I definitely have seen that. And then honestly, even in marriage workshops and books on marriage or relationships, it's always the books are, and workshops are all about how men need to figure women out. Right. And it's and it's not ever the other way around. And I think that's something that I've really learned as I've been through marriage, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I need all the help I can get. I'm trying to read these books and go to the workshops and stuff. And I'm realizing like they're all about Mike having to figure me out. And the ones that are most helpful are the ones that explain to me gently but firmly, what are the needs of a man? How does he think? What makes him come alive? And that's something that I really feel strongly about. I just wanted to say in this, because it's so ground level and practical to be aware of, that just comes out.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you said that. Because even if we're just looking at, I mean, basic TV shows today, in the last 20 to 30 years, they've all taken this turn to where the woman has to, it's not that women can't be strong. I'm all about women being strong. Like, you know, I believe that I know, and that, you know, like, you're a strong woman, I'm a strong woman, that's a great thing. But they do it at the expense of the men in many of these shows, like just like you're describing. And I would say, I would even see it as a disservice, not only to the women that, you know, are adult at this point, but especially to the young men and women in our culture today. I think one of the gravest dangers is that we keep, like, in educating them, it's like we're talking about all these things, but we're, like, forgetting the main thing. You know, like, we keep talking about, we need to learn X, Y, Z, but I feel like we never talk about those things that are the most important, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, if my future daughter goes off to college and she has this really bad relationship end, you know, like some kind of relationship, and when I say bad, I mean, like, the ending itself is just so traumatic for her, which it is for most young women, right? Because just sort of how we were created and the beautiful way we're made. But that is going to affect her in a way so much more deeply, in my opinion, than, you know, okay, maybe she didn't do as well on this calculus test. And I really feel like we need to give our youth and our young adults these tools, which include just what you're saying, you know, because John Paul II said, in teaching woman modesty, you know, I've heard so many modesty talks. I give modesty talks. I love them. They're amazing. But I think we're doing a disservice to women if we're not acknowledging, like, there's a point to this. The modesty is not just that we can parade ourselves around and be like, look at us, we're virtuous women. Like, that has nothing to do with it. Like, that's not the point. The point is that we're choosing to love ourselves and to love our brothers by coming to understand how they've been created and acknowledging that, you know what, they're different, but that is so good. Like, praise God that they're different. And let's come to understand how they've been made, too.
Yeah, there's, especially with modesty, which is a whole nother episode, for sure.
Yeah, I know. We can talk about that forever.
Like, there's that whole, like, mindset that women struggle with, you know, why should it be my problem? You know, why should their struggles be my problem?
Kind of a thing. Yeah, there's a lot of blogs now that I've seen, too, about, like, yoga pants or this and that. And a lot of people are really going at it with that topic, which, you know, in my thoughts, and I would love to hear yours as well, I feel like it's sort of this, we keep trying to throw it on the other when it needs to be an integrated, like, both ends, which is that, okay, here's the reality. Woman's body was made in such a way from the beginning that when man looks upon her, even rightly, okay, right, he sees her and he says, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, and he is drawn in. That is beautiful and that is so good. So after the fall, it's not that he is drawn in any less, right, but it's that there's this temptation that when he sees her, he's not always realizing this great dignity that she's been endowed with. And sometimes he forgets that, you know, when she was created, God drew man to himself through the beauty of woman and vice versa. But sometimes, like, our vision's a little bit, like, it just shifts, you know, we have to shift it back. And it's always about refining that integration, and that's the battle and the life of virtue and the constant conversion that we're each called to. But it always comes back to, I feel like, we are our brother's keeper, and as women, I'm never going to say that, oh, it's her fault. She needs to take the blame for his sin. That's not at all what I would say. But I would say, I think it's loving, though, if she at least tries to understand how her brother and these men have been created to be drawn to the beauty of woman's body, and then in understanding that great beauty that she has been created with, the invitation to veil that mystery, it doesn't need to be this hard, fast, like, you know, I'm not saying wear a brown paper bag, but just, like, loving herself and him so much that she does believe it important that she's looking for him to see her as a woman and not just an object, and loving him where he is and recognizing he has certain struggles. And you know what? She she can be wearing this beautiful, modest, but still alluring outfit, and he might still commit a sin, but in no way is her act of love any lessened or not important. Like, she's, I feel like, offered in a beautiful way, like, who she is to this person. And at the end of the day, you know, like, that's what God says after, you know, like, with Cain and Abel, and we see that whole story, and he says, like, sin's knocking at the door, but, like, you can be the master over it. The answer is for both parties, because we struggle with lust as well as women. Like, that constant struggle to see the person, and just an understanding that psychologically, biologically, the way men were created, it's different the way that they see the beauty of our bodies than as we see theirs. And not that, you know, we need to say, oh, it's harder for this and it's harder for them, but just acknowledging and respecting that difference, and trying to at least understand and not just put it all on them either, that, like, well, it's all his fault and he needs to deal with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one talk that I heard when I was in college that really hit me about that topic was a wonderful young guy who is married and has children now, but we were talking about modesty, or they were, the people giving the talk, and he said, even just girls jogging around the lake, you know, wearing like the skin tight clothes and bouncing everywhere and short shorts, and that is, any guy who sees her for 2 seconds is going to think, that his first thought that's going to come unbidden is, I'd do that. But the best guys out there, the guys who have a right heart, are going to toss that out with the trash as soon as it comes in their mind. But guys who do not have a right heart about that are going to expound on that and keep going with it in their thoughts, you know? I thought that was a good way to think about it.
Yeah, it's like honoring that the way they've been made. And then, because, I mean, the reality is, like, thoughts, they come and go, but then it's our, as, you know, rational creatures, we choose to entertain or to dismiss a thought, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's where their point of decision then comes in.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I remember asking that to a priest in confession one time, and I said, is it bad that these thoughts come into my head? Like, is that a sin? And he said, well, I sure hope not. Because he said, what you do with them after they get there, you can't help if they get there, but it's what you do with them afterward. If you capture them, if you take control of your thoughts. And that's something that I think is very important for women especially to know, because we do tend to, like, let our, you know, I guess if you're being general, a lot of women struggle with letting our thoughts run away with us, and learning how to rein those in and speak truth to them is so important.
And I think, you know, that brings up a really good point that I love to just continue to delve into. I myself am continuing to learn, especially with St. Eve Stein and her writings on women. She talks a lot about the beautiful gift of woman's emotions, which I think are very intertwined with our thinking. So we're just talking about the men and sort of their connection with the physical and their thoughts. And, like, for women, I think that's sort of the primary route, is especially within our emotions. And St. Edith Stein says that, you know, recognizing the Greek, I'm obviously paraphrasing, she wrote it in a beautiful way, but she said, recognizing the dignity and the goodness of how God created woman, we acknowledge that she has a rich emotional life, but we need to educate woman as she's growing up. And, you know, we're never too old to learn, so even us who haven't heard about this before, but we need to educate women that you're still a rational creature, and you can allow your reason to guide your emotions. And I think that's just so important, because it could be so tempting. You know, just as I would say in Love and Responsibility, John Paul II, he talks about how some people, they're going to have different sort of, like, levels of sort of a sensuality that's natural just to their temperament, their personality, how they've been created.
Yeah.
And that's okay. You can have a very rich sensuality that you can still, like, harbor in and allow to be guided and live through virtue. And I think that, like, on the flip side, that very much connects the woman and her emotions. Like, you can have a very rich and maybe some would say, like, just passionate emotional life, you know, like, just like this passionate woman, and she has these emotions, and they're right there. However, they're that much more powerful, I believe, and that much more able to almost move through towards, like, a good fruit for the woman and for those people in her life when they are ordered and guided by reason.
Absolutely. I feel like you just spoke the heart behind the Right Heart podcast when we're on, that is so my heart on what I hope this podcast does is help our formation and help learn that truth so that we can speak it to ourselves when we are in these everyday life situations, our relationships, our problems. And St. Edith Stein has been a great inspiration for the podcast, and I'm so glad you brought her up.
Oh, yeah. I'm so glad that came up. It just seemed really connected. And I love, too, how you said it's a way in which we can, once we learn, we can speak it to ourselves, because, you know, there's so many ways in which we could take this, but I feel like when we remember, like, Christ, we refer to him as the Word, and at the end of the day, like, that is the literal, but also the figurative. That is the final word on our person and on who we are as women. And I think because we, you know, Our Lady, we talk about how she pondered all these things in her heart, right? And what does it mean to ponder? Well, it means to ruminate and to chew and to sit with and to kind of mull over in your mind, like, in your heart, because they're so connected and, like, one, like your soul. As a woman, we do that in a beautiful way, but it's sort of like testing those things, right? And, like, testing, okay, this emotion that's being flared up, is this a positive thing? Or I guess I shouldn't say positive, but is it something that's, like, ordered and just to the situation I'm in? Or is this me, because I'm included in this, is this me just letting my emotions kind of run away? Yeah, and I'm like freaking out about something that is not even rational.
Yeah.
I'm so guilty of that, you know? And once we are able, you know, it's a habit. All habits are things that require discipline over time, right? And I think for me, in a certain way, I love talking about this, but I can only talk about it because I'm like with all of you, like in the battle, trying to understand this and trying to live this. And it's something that I know for myself I want to continue and feel very called to continue working on. And using the power of Scripture, just to throw that out there, like the gift of the Word that he's given us to combat those things that might enter in that are taking my emotions for, like, and just having a field day. You know, like he called it mental gymnastics. He's like, you just got to stop playing the mental gymnastics. I'm like, yeah, I think you're right. Because I'm just driving myself crazy trying to figure everything out, you know?
Yeah, so absolutely.
I hope that makes sense, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And Sarah, I wanted to get your thoughts on femininity as far as our calling to live out maternity. And I know I've talked to you before about this, and I just was so blessed by your thoughts on it, because just the idea that our maternal calling, like, it is universal for all women, but it can be lived out differently. And I'm not even talking about, you know, one woman has biological children and one woman can be a spiritual mother. I'm talking about there are a million ways to be a good mother, and there's no one formula, you know, for being the perfect mom. So I don't know if I just said everything, but just please speak to that for us.
Yeah. And you know, just the foundation we'll put there is just what you had just said, I think, towards the end, which is John Paul II, this beautiful encyclical that we can all access online. I highly recommend. It's called Mulier Dignitatem. It translates to On the Dignity and Vocation of Women. And he does a beautiful job of just kind of explaining that, like, at the core of who she is as woman, what separates her from man is that man has the capacity to be father, woman has the capacity to be mother. And with that capacity comes that call and that mission and that beautiful role. And all women are called to be spiritual mothers. Some will have the great gift to be biological mothers as well. But the thing I remember in our conversation is kind of my little soapbox, but I think just so often, you know, we have started this show and we talk about kind of the struggle within feminism of women versus men. And I think if we take a step back, we can even see, like, there's this huge struggle of women versus women. You know, there's,
I think
as women, we need to remember that we have this propensity to compare. And dare I say, sometimes it is an actual temptation, because it typically takes us away from the center of, this is who I am and the gift of who I have been created to be. And we're looking at that as if the measuring stick is this other woman instead of Christ, right?
Oh, I love that. That's it.
And so, you know, I think without trying to get too crazy about it, because sometimes I can just go off on a tangent about this, but I think what I've encountered is that sometimes as women, or just even in the church, I'll say specifically, the place that we are supposed to come to find our rest and our home, I think we end up becoming our own worst enemies. And we can understand why some people might be turned away if we would look at how we treat each other sometimes. Because mm-hmm. I've just seen these sort of trends of like where we take something that is objectively neither good nor bad. It can be what it's a neutral. It's how you offer it, right? Whatever decision you're making concerning motherhood, whether that's how am I choosing to deliver my child, right? Am I doing a C-section? Am I doing a natural delivery? Am I doing a water birth? How am I raising my children? How do I discipline them? Am I homeschooling them? Am I sending them to regular school? Am I sending them to public school? How am I feeding them, right? Like, am I completely aware of and into the information that we have regarding health? Or do my kids sometimes eat cold pizza for breakfast, right? Like, I know that I'm saying kind of crazy things, but I really do believe it. It even goes back to even, like, you know, I think sometimes there's this temptation even in, like, well, what are you wearing? Like, and we kind of like take all of these things and we act as if there's one way to be a holy, not only mother, but a holy woman. And we end up tearing each other apart. And it's really, I mean, I really think not only is it sad, but it's not the fruit of the Holy Spirit. It's the fruit of the enemy because it causes division. That's very obvious. But it also is very painful. I think as mothers, and I'm not a mother, you know, at this point in my life, biologically, I hope to be called to that one day, but I think as mothers, we would beat ourselves up enough, you know, wondering if we're doing the right thing. And as my mom always tells me, it's not like we were given this, you know, this book that says, like, this is how to raise your kids and, like, just do X, Y, and Z and they'll turn out great, you know? Like, for this unique time and this unique place in the culture and in the history, there's so many ways in which you can be mother. And what I was saying before is, you know, we take these actions that I think are morally neutral and we sort of posit them as if, well, if you do it this way, then you are truly holy. And so you will have, you know, quote, better kids, you're a better mother, you're a better wife, et cetera. Yeah. When the reality comes back to what I believe was stated so simply when the visionaries asked Our Lady of Medjugorje, they asked her, they said, why are you so beautiful? And she did not say it's because, oh, it's the way I did my hair this morning, or, you know, oh, I wore my veil like this. Like, it had nothing to do with that. She said very simply, I am beautiful because I love. And I think that says everything. I remember listening very intently because I was like 16 when I first heard this. I'm like, oh, Our Lady, she's beautiful. Like, this beautiful woman in the world. Like, what's her secret? You know, like, what does it mean? And I look back at it now and I realize, you know, when we look at even the ways that Our Lady has appeared to different people and places and times in history, she always appears in the garb and sort of the dress of the culture in the time in which she's appearing, you know? So to Juan Diego, mm-hmm. he wasn't afraid of her, you know, because of the grace, but also because she was dressed as one of the native women from where he was from and from that culture. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I was thinking about the measuring stick of Christ, and he has given to us the beautiful gift of his mother, who is so intimately connected and participates in salvation history in a unique and essential way. And he shows us not this like mirror that it's like, hey, you need to wear your hair like this or do this. All the physical things that I think are so easy for us to fall into and be tempted to change about ourselves and become. And instead, there's only one thing that she holds up as the measuring stick, as the almost the source that we walk from and then come back towards, which is, I am beautiful because I love. So the question is, whether you were the mother who had all C-sections, whether you had the gift and the grace, it's a grace, you know, to deliver your children naturally, or the grace to homeschool, or the grace to send your children to Catholic school, or the grace that your family was called to send your children to public school. Like, whatever it may be, the question is not this objective black and white, like, have you done this? Can you check off that box? But instead it's, have you done this with an offering of love on behalf of your child?
Mm-hmm. Sarah, so I love that you are talking about this because you have observed this struggle, even though you're not married and have children right now, you have observed this struggle. And it, I know as a youngish mother, it really is affirming to have somebody tell me that this is a norm. This is something that they've seen that is, it's a thing. It's not all in my head. There is that kind of competition and that struggle. And I love also though, the affirmation that there are so many ways to be a good mother if done with love. And I know I wrote a post on my blog Humble Handmade a few years ago. There was a new mother in my community who had emailed a bunch of us asking for parenting advice. What are your favorite books? I'm about to have my first baby. And the slew of emails from this extremely faithful Christian Catholic community, or mostly Catholic community, it was crazy. People were like, don't read this book. That guy ought to be sent to prison. Read this book. This is what every Catholic parent should know. Don't do this. Don't do that. But like, it was crazy how it turned negative really quickly. And I kind of, in response to that post, I did a lot of thinking and I was like, you know what? There is no one way to do it, because your personalities as a couple, as a family, are different. Your job situation, your financial situation, just so many things go, your health, your children's health, any special needs going on with anyone in the family. And you really have to, say, is my family or my children and my marriage, are they growing in grace and stature before the Lord? Is my marriage strong? Is any decision that I'm making, that we are making as parents, causing our marriage to struggle in some way? If not, then great. But if there's a yes to that question, really saying, what is the vocation? And the vocation is to marriage, right? The children, not every couple is going to have children. And so that really reminds me that it is the marriage. So just thinking, you know, that whole perspective of getting your priorities in order, and are we God honoring? Are we healthy? Are we happy? Are we even life-giving to the people around us, to even extended family members? Or do we make people nervous around us because we're so neurotic that we cry if the grandma gives the kids a lick of her ice cream cone? Do we burst into tears? Or can we never go anywhere because of some parenting decision, and our marriage is so suffering and stressed out that we don't even know what to do? Some people really just need somebody to point things out to them, I think.
Yeah.
Every once in a while. So that was kind of a long spiel about that, but I love that you brought this point up, because again, that maternal calling is so universal and can be lived out well and faithfully, and the Lord can say, well done, my good and faithful servant, to things that look very different from family to family.
You know, I just was thinking as you're speaking beautifully, like Saint Therese, you know, I love to relate to Saint Therese because I'm like, okay, like she wanted everything, you know, like whenever they would offer her, like as a child, different things, she's like, I want it all, you know. And so I feel like we can relate to that sometimes. We're like, wait, I just want everything. You know, we want all this good and beautiful things, and we were created with good and beautiful desires. And it's one day, like, as she was growing and maturing and where the Lord had her, she realized, you know, I've realized it. I know what it is. I know my vocation. And she didn't say it in this, it's to do it this way or to do this way. She said, my vocation is to love. And I think in a very unique way, as women, as the ones who have been created, you know, been created last, like the Lord had a timing and even order, as we read in scripture, like the beauty of that, of just like the gift of woman to be a guardian of life and to bring it to fruition, not only biologically, but spiritually. And we just bring that back to, because it's always a fruit of love.
So beautiful, Sarah. And I love your point that you had earlier, like it always, any topic or any problem or any issue that we have, maybe regarding feminism or maternity or just who we are as women, goes back to the dignity of woman, the dignity of the person, as expressed specifically by the feminine nature. It's just any decisions always go back to that kind of. Okay, so this is a big question. I'm gonna dare to say this is gonna be a little bit of a long episode, but while I have you here, I do want to have you back on to talk about this more later. But as far as reproductive rights, I'd really like you to speak just some basic truths to that 1960s introduction of the birth control pill and the idea of that today, and just speak truth to that for listeners.
Okay, so, you know, I'm a Korean practitioner, I have been able to study, I guess, more in depth just about, you know, biology, anatomy of women, and but also having the gift of being exposed to theology of the body, I've been also able to see a woman's role from a theological standpoint. So whenever I look at these sorts of issues, I like to look at them through that integrated lens of, you know, woman's calling, body, soul, composite, like who is she?
Mm-hmm.
And when we look back at the pill, I also want to point out, I think the Holy Spirit is a genius. I guess that's sort of self-evident, but just the timing, if we look at history, the pill sort of released, I would say officially in 1960, and they'd done a lot of experiments, but if you read the experiments they did on women and different things that they used, even to like count the days, like in foreign countries, and the women would be using rosary beads to like count the days that they would remember that they took the pill, like just crazy stuff. And the experiments were not always successful and did sometimes even result in the death of these poor women. But in 1960, not only was the pill released, but Carl Wojtyla, so John Paul II, before he was Pope, he wrote Love and Responsibility. And I think, well, for me, maybe it's just because I think about these things all the time, but I think that just says so much about, you know, whenever the Lord, he's not absent, you know, and it's not that the church didn't believe the beautiful things about love and responsibility, which talks about just the not just philosophically, but really just the beautiful experience of what it means to be a man, of what it means to be a woman, of how do we live out this calling to be holy when we have these attractions and these desires, and like, how do we integrate them? And so it's like when this was released in the scientific community, the church and the Holy Spirit and her wisdom, this is the perfect time in response to that. Not that he even knew, you know, this is happening necessarily. I'm sure he did in some way. But the Holy Spirit had led him there, that's when that was also released. And I just think that's kind of a beautiful, like, to show us as women the last 55 years, like, this is what a time to be a woman, you know, because
yeah.
I would say reproductive rights is one of the, like, kind of the buzzwords right now, you know, like in the culture. And I think it will be for a long time, because in just the bioethics realm, there's so many technologies surrounding what I would say is how we can manipulate woman's body in her capacity to bear life, and how we can manipulate the smallest form of that and the potential through the gametes, through the eggs, through the sperm, et cetera. But, you know, unfortunately, I would say just, I know we don't have a lot of time. We'll talk about this more, I'm sure, at another time, but the birth control pill is something that I would almost, you know, as an analogy, I would say it's kind of like you go into the store when you're a kid and, like, you ask your mom to buy you that Hershey's candy bar. Like, you want the candy. Like, I feel like it's handed out almost like it's candy. Like, you go to the doctor's office. Any woman I know, whether it's because she's having migraines or having an irregular period or maybe she's having a really painful period, she's offered the pill. And I want to first acknowledge that the sufferings of women on the biological side of things are very real. And I know women that have been through extreme pain with their cycle, especially within their period. You know, they're having issues with endometriosis or polycystic ovarian disease. These are very real and painful experiences and realities for many women. And for most of the medical community and most of the world then, they don't know that there's an option better than the pill. So I want to acknowledge that I'm not saying that if a woman's on the pill, that she somehow, once again, we're not going to put that in this box and say she's less of a woman or less holy because she's on it, right? And I'm keeping out of this, like, the, you know, using it to avoid having a child, or that's for another show. But right now, just
okay.
Let's say that, you know, the average teenager who isn't sexually active, let's hope, right, and she's just on it for medical reasons. Like, the reality of even the medical purposes is that most people don't know that there's something better than this. So I seem biased because I'm teaching this method called Cretan Model, but I'm biased because I sat there after my women's studies class, and I remember getting in a heated argument with someone who was telling us that, you know, you have to, you know, let people, like, they can't be on the pill. There's never a good reason to be on the pill. And I'm like, what do I do, Lord? I think there's a truth to, there's got to be a better option than the pill. But then I'm like, blank stare. I don't know what it is, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's got to be a better way. The church is telling us that you don't need this, like, even, you know, within marriage, but especially even as medicine. So I'm like, what is that? Like, what does that mean? And so I realized the gift of the Lord even exposing me a year later to what Cretan Model is. And so Cretan Model is one specific form of charting, but this specific form of charting is directly connected to something called NAPR technology. So when a woman charts with Cretan, she's able to, you know, learn the beauty of her cycle and her fertility. And I would describe it as like a biological diary. So it's literally the language of her body that is being spoken through the biological signs that she can observe every day. So from that information, it can be used as a diagnostic tool. We can see certain patterns. And then with the help of what we call NAPRO technology, so natural procreative technology, the doctor can do the necessary blood work, can prescribe for the necessary medicine. And the goal is always, instead of manipulating her body to do something it's not supposed to be doing, which is cutting off her cycle or keeping her from having normal cycles, right? It's trying, the goal is to restore the reproductive integrity of her body.
And really, I wanted to interject there that really what my understanding of NAPRO technology is that it really looks for the symptoms, like not the symptoms, the causes of
that's
the symptoms.
Exactly it. So if you have, you know, painful periods or, you know, even really endometriosis, polycystic ovarian disease, infertility. Infertility itself it's a symptom of an underlying issue, and you as a woman deserve to find out what that issue is. And MIST is all seeking to help you discover that, and if possible, to help in some way either fix it or at least let you know, like, the root of what is causing all these symptoms and to help alleviate that, but in a way that respects your natural biological system. Because even the hormones that we use for NAPRO technology when they're prescribed for a woman, they're actually bioidentical. So they're created in the lab, they're artificial, but they're bioidentical in the sense that their molecular structure is identical to the molecular structure of the hormones that our body naturally creates. So you're not introducing something that is like even like foreign kind of in that sense, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And just to clarify too, what I was saying before about, you know, the church obviously, I just want to make it clear, you know, we do say, you know, we don't want to prescribe to you use the pill because you're trying to avoid having a child. We would invite couples to come to understand their fertility and have recourse to the natural rhythm of their cycle. But once again, I just want to acknowledge if you're listening to this podcast, because I feel like so many people get turned off so fast when we talk about these things. It's not that I'm saying I don't understand that you might have been on the pill for the last 10 years because your mother and your father have never heard about this. They didn't know any better, and this is what the doctor put you on. But I want to invite you to come to learn now that you know that there's a better option. I'm not expecting you to knock down the door tomorrow and come and learn Cretin, you know, whatever system works better for you, but in specifically the science, I would recommend this as the system for you. But to come to learn the facts about the birth control pill and to know that it's a class A carcinogen, meaning it's in the top class of cancer-causing agents. The same class as asbestos and formaldehyde. So it's more than just this sort of political issue or this like, well, it's my right, I can do whatever I want. Like, you know, it is your body and do whatever you want, but I want you to have all the information, and I want to say that you deserve a better option than the birth control pill for whatever you are experiencing with your body.
And it really even speaks to and upholds your dignity as a woman to dive into a natural understanding of your particular body, your particular problems or things going on in there. And even in your husband, because NAPRO technology can also look at the fertility, the overall fertility of a man as well, which is something I actually learned kind of recently and is very cool.
Yeah. And the gift that it's always trying to respect the beauty of the fertility of the couple. And, you know, if she's not married, still it's for her, it's medicine, the beauty and of the fertility of this young woman, and not to be afraid of your fertility, but to know that truly this is an amazing time to be a woman, that we can even have the capacity to understand these things. I would really encourage and almost beg women to try and do what they can to learn more about themselves, because with the gift of self-awareness, you know, we're talking about feminism this whole episode, like with that gift of self-awareness, there comes this freedom because of the great awareness that you have of your dignity, that you now have this freedom and this desire to treasure that dignity and also to demand it of others in your relationships, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm speaking specifically like for those young women. I really encourage young women, you know, like 12 years old and up, like whenever they're starting puberty, like that they would even if they don't chart every day, but that they would learn what it is involved with it and a chart for at least a few months at some point in time in their adolescence, that they could see the language that their body speaks. And through that great gift of self-awareness, I think it's almost a natural promotion of chastity for them, because they see like, oh, wow, like, look at how God made my body. Like, it was made to do this. And they're more encouraged, I think, that they recognize that they're not just any old little pebble on the street, you know, like they're pearls. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to throw their pearls before swine.
Absolutely. Sarah, I know that you are full of wisdom and knowledge and full of amazing quotes that you like to pull out everywhere. And when we were meeting a few weeks ago and we were getting excited and talking about the episode, you said, we need to end with a quote. I just have so many. And so anyway, I wanted to see if I could throw that on you at the end and you could pull out one of your very favorites that sums up this beautiful episode that we've been recording tonight.
Wonderful. I will admit that I've had a hard time picking which quote. There's like three that I'm in love with. They're all from different documents, but I would encourage women that there's a particular document that's really short and very easy to read. You can just Google it, but it's John Paul II's Letter to Women. It's like a few pages. And in that, he thanks every woman just for being woman. And he says that through her relationship, she helps to make the world just more authentic, which is just amazing. But the quote that I want to go with to really kind of, I guess, bring everything together actually comes from the closing speech of the Second Vatican Council, so from 1965. And though it's from 1965, when I read it, I think everyone will agree, holy cow, like this is such a quote for our time today. And I think that's the thing, like the Holy Spirit, like eternity outside of time, like speaking truth to the now. It's a little long, but I think it's worth it. And so this is what it says. It says, the hour is coming, in fact has come, when the vocation of women is being acknowledged in its fullness, the hour in which women acquire in the world an influence, an effect, and a power never hitherto achieved. That is why, at this moment, when the human race is undergoing so deep a transformation, women impregnated with the spirit of the gospel can do so much to aid humanity in not falling. Our technology runs the risk of becoming inhuman. Reconcile men with life, and above all, we beseech you, watch carefully over the future of our race. Hold back the hand of man who, in a moment of folly, might attempt to destroy human civilization. Lastly, women in trial, who stand upright at the foot of the cross like Mary, you who so often in history have given to men the strength to battle unto the very end and to give witness to the point of martyrdom, aid them now still once more to retain courage in their great undertakings, while at the same time maintaining patience and an esteem for humble beginnings. Women of the entire universe, whether Christian or non-believing, you to whom life is entrusted at this grave moment in history, it is for you to save the peace of the world.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's so profound. I can't believe that was 1965.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 50 years ago.
What came to my mind as you were reading that, that I wanted to share as a final thought for me, for the episode, is that just the greatness and the greatness and firmness of the Catholic Church, of the Church mm-hmm. with a capital C that goes all the way back to Christ. People are going to fail you. Priests will fail you. Counselors are going to fail you. And the fact that we have a church that writes truth, that teaches truth, even if sometimes the people on the ground level are not living that out, are not teaching it, don't understand it, don't even know what they're missing. We have to appreciate and acknowledge that they are not the church. The church as a whole, as going all the way back to Christ, has it going on. It has such great truth, and we always need to go back to the catechism, go back to the writings of the church, because those are not going to fail us. Those are going to speak the truth to us. So I just want to encourage anybody who has just a bad feeling or bad experience with what they think is the church to go back to what the Catholic Church actually teaches, because it is beautiful, it is truth, it is solid, and it has not changed since the time of Christ. It has only been expounded upon and explained in light of changing cultures over time, and it's beautiful. So I just want to encourage readers to, or listeners to really dare to dive into that and to dive past their experiences and past what they think they know about the Catholic Church. Because I hear quotes like that and I read the work of John Paul II and I think, how can we have such ignorance in our mass media, in our own parishes, with even, you know, some of our holy priests who are otherwise so good and trying, but they just, you know, sometimes they don't understand. And
yeah, and the beauty of what you just said, like, is remembering that even the church, we refer to her as mother, you know, like, and it doesn't matter what we've been through or what we've done or how these other people have failed us, but to remember that, like, that perfect mother, you know, like, we can always run back to her and, like, run back into her arms and, like, express honestly, I'm struggling with this, like, why do you teach, you know, this? And I think my favorite part, just as a closing thought on that quote just now, is it talks about how women impregnated with the spirit of the gospel can do so much to aid humanity and not falling. And, like, that image of, like, being impregnated with the gospel, like, at the end of the day, just to remember, like, our measuring stick, right, is Christ. And he's given to us the gift of Our Lady, who is our mother, who desires to take our hand as little children and to walk forward towards Christ at all times. And that when we look at the gospel, we see a Lord and a Savior and a man who treats women with the utmost respect and reverence and the utmost love, and recognizes, like, the beautiful strength and witness of women and who they are, and how he speaks to every woman, no matter if she was the gravest of sinners, right, or his own mother. And that, like, by allowing our own hearts and minds to start to chew and to ruminate on the gospel, on that word, we start to transform the culture from the inside out, not just with our words are we living the gospel, but with our hearts, with our whole person, just by who we are, by being the women that we are called to be. And so we're responding to our vocation, which is to love.
Can you guys tell why I could totally just go through pots and pots of coffee talking to Sarah all day long? she's just so amazing. And I think we're definitely kindred spirits and as women. Yes. So Sarah, thank you. Thank you again for coming on The Right Heart. I promise to have you back on again. And that's a promise to listeners too. Specifically, you have so much to say and so much to share on the bioethics of reproductive technologies that we dove into a little bit today. So I'll have you back, I promise, and thank you again.
Perfect. Thank you so much for having me, and God bless to all the listeners as well.
And thank you, listeners, for listening to The Right Heart today. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Sarah Denny is such a beautiful soul, and I have loved getting to know her again. She is one of those people that the more you get to know her, the longer she talks and you see her heart, the more beautiful she gets. And if you're curious about upcoming guests or when I'm about to get new show notes up on the blog, definitely make sure that you like the podcast on our Facebook page or follow me at Erin Franco on Twitter. Always feel free to send me any comments or emails, show or guest ideas. I so love to hear from listeners because it is a labor of love to do the podcast, and any kind of feedback, good or bad, you know, helpful criticism is totally fine. I would just love to hear from you. All right, guys, until next time, peace be with you and your families, and God bless.